Today's talk is about the five skandhas, or five aggregates. Let's start with a dialogue from the Pali Canon. The teacher here is a fully awakened nun, Dhammadina, and her student is her partially awakened ex-husband, Visakha. Visakha starts the dialogue asking, "Lady, how does self-identity come about?" Sister Dhammadina answers, "There is the case, friend Visakha, where an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person who has no regard for people of integrity, is not well-versed or disciplined in their dharma, assumes the form to be the self as possessing form, or the form as in the self, or the self as in form. He assumes feeling to be the self," and she repeats the same formulation, "assumes the self to as possessing feeling, feeling as in the self as in feeling. He assumes perception to be the self. He assumes mind formations to be the self. He assumes consciousness to be the self, or the self as possessing consciousness, or consciousness as in the self, or the self as in consciousness. This is how self-identity comes about." Visakha asks, "But lady, how does self-identity not come about?" And Sister Dhammadina answers, "There is the case where a well-instructed disciple who has regard for men of integrity, is well-versed and disciplined in the Dhamma, does not assume form to be the self, or the self as possessing form, or form as in the self, or the self as in form. He does not assume feeling to be the self. He does not assume perception to be the self. He does not assume mind formations to be the self. He does not assume consciousness to be the self." Today's talk is about the categories of experience that Dhammadina discussed with her ex. And for the record, she was teaching Visakha the same things that the Buddha himself taught on numerous occasions. I thought about titling this talk, "What We're Not and How to Practice with That." In that vein, let's be clear on what we are not talking about today. Despite all the discussion in Buddhist circles about there being no self, the Buddha was actually strangely silent on that particular topic. Vachagota, a wandering mendicant, visited the Buddha and asked him if there was such a thing as the self. The Buddha didn't answer him, but just sat silently. Vachagota then asked if there was no self, and again the Buddha was silent, and Vachagota walked away with his curiosity completely unsatisfied. Ananda, the Buddha's personal attendant, was puzzled by his silence and asked him to explain, and the Buddha replied, "Ananda, if I were to answer that there is a self, that would be conforming with those priests and contemplatives who are exponents of eternalism. If I were to answer that there is no self, that would be conforming with those priests and contemplatives who are exponents of annihilationism. And if I were to answer that there is a self, would that be keeping with the arising of knowledge that all phenomena are not self?" "No, Lord," said Ananda. "And if I were to answer that there is no self, the bewildered Vachagota would become even more bewildered. Does the self that I used to have now not exist?" Given the situation he was placed in, the Buddha thought that the best response was silence. So we have Dhammadina's answer to her ex-husband that the wise will not find self in form, feeling, perception, mind formations, or consciousness, and we have the Buddha declining to answer Vachagota's direct question about whether or not there is such a thing as a self. I know, looking at those teachings, you can reasonably ask, so what? What am I supposed to do with this? And to get at an answer to that, let's remember that the essential core of the Buddha's teachings are that he taught one topic and one topic only, suffering and the end of suffering. The Four Noble Truths remind us that suffering results from craving, bringing craving to an end brings suffering to an end, and that there is a path that leads to the end of craving. Today's talk is about what is not a permanent essential locus of the self. Realizing the things that are not an essential self comprises wise view, and that realization enables us to release particular kinds of clinging and craving that themselves lead to particular kinds of suffering. So with that framework, let's dive in. There are, I'm sure, dozens of aspects of our existence that comprise at least a part of what we think of as ourself. Some of us may include more, some of us may include fewer, but the Buddha was intensely focused on what I'll call first-person experience, what the experience of being in existence is like from the inside of the sensation. And as I imagine his experience, he probably started with dozens and dozens of aspects of existence, as we all do. But remembering that he taught only one topic, the end of suffering, he articulated five categories of experience that together wrap in all first-person experience, all of the kinds of experiences that we have in life. And the categories get various names depending on the translator, but as I think of them, and as Dhammadina outlined them, they are form, feeling tone, perception, mind formations, and consciousness. In this talk, we'll focus a bit on each of these categories and how we might use an awareness of each category of existence to enable us to experience them more clearly. That may or may not lead us to the conclusions that the Buddha reached about these categories, or skandhas, as he called them in Pali. But for my part, I think practice and experience are better teachers than concepts and memorization. So let's start with form. It's not controversial, I'd bet, to say that most of us have, at one time or another, been dissatisfied with some aspect of our bodies. Too small, too large, too light, too dark, too narrow, too wide, too this, too that. And worse yet, the condition of the body has changed over time. We've gotten sick, or larger, or smaller, less of this, more of that. And while we found reason to be dissatisfied, at least at some point, it was more than a cool analytical conclusion. It was suffering at our very cores. And when we look in the mirror, we see a different image in this moment than we saw the last time we looked. Maybe it's only a very slightly different image, but different nonetheless. Never exactly the same as last time, especially if we look very closely, notice minutely what's going on. Maybe some days we're pleased by the changes we discover from the last time we looked, maybe other days we're dismayed. The category of form includes all physical and tangible experience. There is, the Buddha taught, no essential self embedded in the physical experience of bodies. And when it came to thinking about form, the Buddha's use of the term was wider than you might think. Again, he was focused on suffering, not on self. So when he teaches non-attachments to form, he's including more than just the body. He's including every experience that can be had through physical form, which, if you're a thoroughgoing materialist, is everything. Don't get attached to carrots, or massages, or free weights, or concrete sidewalks, or iPads, or lovers, or cheeseburgers, or runs in the wilderness, or cocktails, or anything you encounter in physical form. This is a very big category, and for some of us, it may be the only category we've ever really considered for locating the self, for identifying with. The Buddha looked at physical form of existence, and he investigated the experience of being a self, and he saw clearly enough that form was constantly changing. So if there were a permanent essential self, it couldn't be located in physical form. So he taught his followers to be wary of clinging to attachments to physical form. I tend to hear in the Buddha's words about physical form not only the caution not to cling or crave the bodies of Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie, but also not to cling or crave the opposite of the spectrum, extreme asceticism. Remember that the Buddha's path before awakening took him through what we'd call today an eating disorder that nearly killed him. Even when it comes to form, hating something that is undesirable is the same essential experience as craving something that is desirable. When the Buddha talks about clinging or craving, he's referring to both attachment to pleasant things as well as aversion to unpleasant things. So how do we practice with the skandha of form? It's pretty easy. You bring awareness to the sensations of the body. Because our karmic patterns regarding appearances are so deeply ingrained in many of us, it's easiest, I think, to start form awareness practice with the eyes closed. Just notice the sensations of being in a body. Body awareness. Sit still and comfortably, and then notice in which parts of your body you can feel sensations, and in which ones you can't. Follow the breath sensations. Practicing only mindfulness of the body, some Buddhist meditation masters insist, can take you all the way to the brink of awakening. As a practical matter, it's about 90% of the practice that I do. The second category, or skandha, that the Buddha used to capture a different aspect of first-person experience is vedana, usually translated as feeling tone. This one may be intuitively natural to you, or you may be like I was when I first learned of it, completely confused. So here it is. Every experience arises in awareness, accompanied by a feeling tone. Every experience registers as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Let me say that again. Every experience arises in awareness with an accompanying feeling tone. Every experience registers as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Because that language is awkward, I'll mostly refer during the rest of this talk to the neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling tone as neutral, but that can be a bit misleading in ways that I'll point out and are worth keeping in mind. Also note what I'm not saying. I'm not saying that everything in life is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral in and of itself. I'm talking about the first-person experience of something arising with a feeling tone. Also note another thing I'm not saying. I'm not saying that there's two separate things going on, the experience of something and the feeling tone of something. Instead, I'm saying that the experience itself entails an aspect that can be perceived directly as a feeling tone. This may get easier with examples. Some examples, it's easiest to see at the extremes, but as we get better at noticing the feeling tone directly, we can refine our focus and awareness to notice things with only the slightest of charges, positive or negative or neutral, and we can notice compound experiences with similarly compound feeling tones. The easiest. Easiest are the things we really crave. If you're a coffee devotee, perhaps it's the first taste of coffee in the morning. It comes with a strongly pleasant feeling tone. If you're a nature lover, it's the feeling tone that is part of the experience that arises when you get deep enough into nature or wilderness that you suddenly relax into the environment. If you're a fitness fanatic, it may be the feeling tone that is a part of the experience after you've warmed up and are several minutes into a hard exercise when aches and pains subside into the feeling of flowing strength. Also easy to perceive are the things that we really dislike. The feeling tone of unpleasant that arises when we get a paper cut on a finger. The feeling tone of unpleasantness that arises when you hear somebody whining. Or the feeling tone that arose the first time you tasted something incredibly bitter like tonic water or kale. The neutral feeling tone, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, arises frequently, but because it doesn't trigger our grasping or aversion, we can easily not notice it. It arises when we encounter daily objects, a pencil, a napkin, or a shopping bag, the sensation of daily clothes against your skin. So with those three, that sets the stage for a noting-style meditation, where instead of sitting, noting, and labeling each mind-body experience according to its category, sensation, thought, seeing, hearing, etc., we label each mind-body event according to its feeling tone, positive, neutral, negative. This sounds pretty simplistic, and conceptually it is exactly that. But with that kind of focus, we start to recognize that our tendency toward grasping arises in response to and immediately following a mind or body event that has a positive feeling tone. And we equally start to recognize that our tendency toward aversion arises in response to and immediately following a mind or body event that has a negative feeling tone. Curiously enough, distraction, restlessness, sleepiness, boredom, those arise in response to and immediately following a mind-body event that has a neutral feeling tone. Becoming increasingly aware of feeling tones is kind of a valuable tool in the kit of mindful living. As with the skanda of form, vedana, or feeling tone, lends itself nicely to a vipassana sitting meditation practice, where we can focus directly on the feeling tones without being concerned about driving into a median strip. But instead of registering the mind on the nature of the sensation as we would with a typical noting practice that might sound like feeling, hearing, seeing, feeling, hearing, hearing, tasting, etc., we shift our attention slightly to register on the mind not the category of the event, but just the nature of the feeling tone that arises with each event. Positive, neutral, positive, negative, 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 positive, neutral, neutral, positive, etc. What happens when we do that? Rather than talk about it, let me recommend that you give it a try this week. I find it particularly helpful in slowly unclenching attachments to particular sensations or lines of thought. If as soon as a thought arises in my head, even a juicy, strong, tempting one, if instead of focusing on the thought's content, I focus on its accompanying feeling tone, I'm usually less tempted to dive into that distraction. Because often enough for me, the most tempting thought tangles that take me away from mindfulness are the ones related to negative feeling tones. And focus on feeling tone may point to a particular experience that involves an unpleasant feeling tone. Or sometimes it may show that the bulk of experiences that are arising in my awareness simply entail unpleasant feeling tones. Why do they arise? Well, karma is decipherable only in small parts, but seeing the feeling tone as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral brings the magic of mindfulness to a process that for most of us, most of the time, is totally unconscious. It's not that clinging is the only possible response to an experience with a pleasant feeling tone, nor that aversion is the only possible response to an experience with a negative feeling tone. But if we don't get skilled at noticing the feeling tone, there'll never be enough space between the feeling tone and the instinctive response, either clinging or aversion, for conscious choice, or for wisdom to enter the equation. But noticing and registering the feeling tone directly is simply an application of mindfulness. And as with mindfulness applied to other experiences, being mindful of a situation creates a tiny space between the experience of something and our response to it. It creates a gap that interrupts the automatic reflex response that we're otherwise programmed to make. Do you ever find yourself eating something without ever consciously deciding to eat at all? Attention to the feeling tone, perhaps the feeling tone of aversion that arises with hunger sensations, or perhaps the feeling tone of craving that arises with the thought of an ice cream sandwich. Attention to those has helped me figure out, after the fact admittedly, why I'm halfway through a pint of Almond Dream chocolate fudge ripple. Perhaps it will be of help to you. The next skanda, or category of experience, is perception. Like feeling tone, this one can be a bit tricky because it's so ingrained in our way of experiencing life that we tend not to notice it at all. I read somewhere that perception is the mind's way of trying to ensure that you never experience something new. It's the operation of mind that says, you don't need to pay attention to this moment because you've already experienced it before. So the first time you taste a French fry, it's wildly a sensory experience. The sense of hot grease on your fingers, the texture of salt grains on the surface, the crispy outside. When it gets near your nose, you pick up not only the scent of the oil, but also the warm potato-y smell. And as you bite into it, you get the grease, then the salt, then the crispness of the outside, then the nothing in the world like it texture of the inside. That's the first time. The second time, you might pick up on the grease and salt grain on your fingertips, the saltiness on your tongue, and the warm potato flavor. The third time your mind registers, French fries. And the fourth time you glance down at an empty grease paper sleeve and think, huh, I must have eaten those and they were probably French fries. At each step, the mind is building a conceptual model of French fry. And with each step toward that conceptual model, the mind's connection between the sensory awareness of a perception and the conceptual model becomes stronger and faster. More neurons are devoted to the A equals B logic circuit, and eventually, what registers in conscious awareness is the concept rather than the perception of the hot, greasy, yummy scent of French fries. And when it's done, you can get through a big pile of French fries and never have actually tasted a single one. Instead of interacting with real live sensory data from real live French fries, you interacted only with your mind's conception of French fries. The step from perception to conception is tiny. In Buddhist meditation practice, perception is what happens when the mind encounters a sensory stream of information that resembles a previously encountered set of sensory information and makes the leap to say, ah, this is a French fry. Unquestionably, there's a huge evolutionary upside to having a brain that makes and builds up rapidly connections between particular sensory perceptions and mental concepts. If every time a person encountered a black and orange vertical stripes moving through the grass, if every time she saw that, she had to stop and consciously think, do I have a concept to which this visual perception can logically be connected? She would end up as a tiger's breakfast rather than running away. So our brains are engineered to make and reinforce those linkages between perceptions and concepts automatically. As a practical matter, that's a good thing even for those of us who don't see tigers too much in our daily lives. The ability to formulate and mentally manipulate concepts allows us to filter the zillions of data bits that are available to us in each moment down to a relatively few number of concepts that we can actually hold in our minds at a given time. But with the subconscious linkages and filtering, there are some distinct downsides as well. We lose real information when we filter perceptions into concepts, and sometimes we make categorical mistakes. Have you ever found yourself singing words to a song you heard on the radio and have someone else bust out laughing because you got the words so wrong? It happens to me all the time. It was just a mistake in perception and concept. Another example, have you ever imagined the experience of a newborn infant? She opens her eyes and sees moving colors and shapes. She doesn't even know what colors are, but she knows that this color, what we might think of as green, is different than that color, what we might think of as yellow. With time, she comes to recognize one set of colors and shapes and sounds and scents as the face of her mother. Different colors and different shapes are different particular objects. This isn't really controversial. Seemingly not all that insightful even when it comes to awakening either, but the point is, perception is a conditioned process. It's an event that depends on accumulated experience and learning, and once the process is established, it leads not only to distinguishing visual objects, but gives rise to conceptual thought processes as well. At the level of optical illusions or pop song lyrics or French fries, this is usually not too much of a problem. But at an interpersonal level, it can be a gigantic one. We develop a concept about who or what a particular person is, and then instead of interacting with the actual person today, tomorrow, we interact with our concept yesterday, last month, last year, instead. In the last few years of her life, my mother was prone to do this with me. Instead of interacting with the living, breathing me of the present moment, she responded to her relatively fixed and relatively out-of-date perception of what she thought of as Sean, which, as best as I could discern, was probably a blend of characteristics that she saw in Sean at age 5, Sean at age 17, and Sean at age 26. Curiously, the last day she managed to get out of bed before she died, she seemed more present for Sean at age 50 than she'd ever been before. But by that day, she had also already let go of so much of what she'd clung to previously. Also, from these kinds of perceptions come stereotypes, or can come stereotypes, and unconscious assertions and assumptions of privilege. From these kinds of fixed perceptions come conclusions that John is my enemy. And with that perception, we start to shape and diminish the number of ways that we interpret John's actions and intentions. Political labels abound, as do assumptions about the goodwill or bad faith of the mind we discern behind a particular action. Perceptions, as modern neuroscience has shown, tend to not only associate current events with previously constructed models of the universe, but they also tend to fill in the gaps between this moment and the pre-built moment in our heads without us even noticing that there was a gap to be filled. And they can lead us, or more accurately, mislead us, into seeing existence as one thing when it really may be something else. If we attach to our perceptions, we blindfold ourselves. What the Buddha realized and taught 2,500 years ago is that working with abstractions always comes at the cost of precision. Even more than feeling tone practice, perception practice is best pursued in meditation, not while driving down the freeway at 70 miles an hour. For freeway driving, perception, conception, thinking mode is just dandy. It handles spatial relationships between visual objects and bodily constructs, and all the rest handles them sufficiently well to keep you off the guardrails and away from other vehicles. But the reason it's on the Buddha's list of skandhas, the structure of a particular mind, a particular acculturated way of seeing and understanding, a set of deeply ingrained identifications, perceptions, and concepts, those can be things that we identify with, that we think of as I, me, mine, or permanent. The Buddha's point about the skandha of perception is that it's conditioned. It's something that arises and morphs over time, something that even if we think it's the only real or right way to cognitively register an object, this is a salad fork. The essentiality, the permanence, the fundamental truthfulness of those perceptions are illusory. Anything that is conditioned is subject to change, even if we think that in this moment it's certain and permanent. The fourth skandha has perhaps the most difficult name, mental formations. What? Mental formations. This one was the hardest puzzle for me. Some Buddhist resources make an effort to itemize every sort of distinctive mental formation that they could imagine arising. The Path of Purification, also called the Visuddhimagga, lists 52 of them. The top 10 were attention, will, determination, confidence, concentration, wisdom, energy, desire, hate, ignorance. And there are 42 others. Apart from a general curiosity about the Buddhist penchant for nearly endless numerical lists, what's most interesting about these for me is the teaching that they're volitional. That is to say, whether or not they are present can be subject to our choice, to our agency. And while I can wrap my brains around the idea that some mental formations are potentially subject to our will, I still struggled for several years to understand this teaching in a way that I could experience directly. So perhaps I can use three illustrations from my own life where I glimpsed a little bit about the choice-based aspects of mental formations. At one point, I was working with practicing equanimity, as I had for several months prior, and I read a suggestion from a Dharma teacher that when the mind stabilizes in basic equanimity, seeing events, whether physical or mental, pleasant or unpleasant, seeing them arise and subside without disturbing the stability and clarity of seeing, when that degree of equanimity arises, the teacher said, then turn the mind to examine the equanimity itself. That teaching, stabilize the mind within a particular mind state and turn the attention toward the nature of mind state itself, enabled me to see something I'd never quite seen before, that the mind itself has a form, it has a structure. And the nature of that form, that structure, affects the nature of experiences that can arise in a given set of conditions. While I generally thought to myself before that insight that various kinds of actions and thoughts could shape my mind, I'd not pursued that understanding as far as to say, the shape of your mind determines what potential experiences are available to you. Note, I didn't say it will determine what conclusions you'll reach, which is kind of obvious, but rather it will determine what experiences can arise in your mind. Now, that's definitely not an endorsement of the magical worldview where you think your exercise of will alone determines particular outcomes. But it's a real-world correlate to such notions, and perhaps it can serve as a way to think further about such matters. But that's a bit of a distraction from the discussion of mental formations. When I followed those teachers' instruction and I turned my attention toward the form of the equanimous mind, I found that it had perceptible characteristics. Quietness, stability, a few hooks or triggers, a basic absence of what Buddhist meditation practice refers to as the five hindrances of greed, hatred, sloth, restlessness, and doubt. So what I'd taken previously as a practice, equanimity, turned out to have a mind shape or a mind form that was associated with it. And I could see that it was volitional, that it was a function of choice or subject to my agency, only a tiny bit and only indirectly. I had no idea how to choose that mind shape, but I did understand that I had invoked it and I had built it to some degree through the meditation practice that I had pursued to that point. A second experience allowed me to see how mental formations can be more subject to volition or to choice, and it occurred during a week-long retreat that I did last year. As a part of the retreat structure, each participant is assigned a community task. Vacuuming, bathroom cleaning, chopping vegetables, whatever. Most of those tasks are done in the morning after breakfast, but I like to use that morning time period, when the weather's dry at least, for sitting or walking meditations outside, or sometimes for picking and eating wild blackberries when I'm not feeling like sitting peacefully. So for the past several years, when I've gone on retreat, I volunteered for one of the tasks that is done in the evening, between dinner and the evening Dharma talk. Typically, the one that I volunteered for most is removing the kitchen mats, sweeping and mopping the kitchen floor, scouring the mats, and then replacing them in the kitchen. And during the years that I've done this job, there are usually three of us assigned to the work to get it done. But last year, when I showed up for the first night of instruction, the cook said there were only two of us assigned to it. My expectations were a bit unsettled, but I wasn't overly distressed. It would just mean that we need to work a bit longer and faster in order to finish in time to clean up and get to the Dharma talk on time. The next night, that's just what happened. The next day, though, I got a note from one of the retreat administrators letting me know that the other participant who'd been assigned to the kitchen floor duty had had to leave the retreat early. But the note advised me the cooks had agreed to haul the mats outside to where I'd scour them and they'd sweep up, so I just mopped the floor, cleaned the mats, and dragged them back into the kitchen. At the point of reading that note, I was a little put out. My "wait, that's not fair" notion came out and reminded me a bit resentfully that this year there was only two of us assigned to do the work, usually assigned to three of us, and now I was the only retreat participant working on it. But the arrangement nonetheless made sense to my mind, and I showed up right on time that evening. The kitchen was dark, so I entered through the back door and flipped on the lights. There the kitchen mats were, all lying on the kitchen floor where they'd been during the meal prep, and I could see there were bits of food and paper and dirt scattered across the floor. The kitchen staff had apparently either not gotten the administrator's message about splitting the work with me, or they'd neglected or forgotten or been unable to do it. And so at the end of a long, difficult meditation day, I found myself wrestling dirty kitchen mats to the back of the building, sweeping and mopping the floors, spraying the mats clean, getting wearier and wearier, more and more resentful, more and more disappointed, more and more unhappy. It took me, of course, twice as long to get the work done as it had previous nights. I even skimped in some parts of the work, trying to shorten the time. And when I'd finally finished the job, my work meditation, I went back to the building and hosed off my arms and legs to get some of the grime off. The kitchen building was situated at the bottom of a long hill, with the meditation hall standing at the top about 200 yards away. It was just past nightfall when I finished up and began trudging up the hill. Then I stopped. I could already see the meditation lights in the hall were on, and through the windows of the hall I could see that the Dharma talk had already started. I was still semi-soaked from the kitchen cleanup. I was resentful that everyone else had not only had time to unwind a bit after dinner, but were sitting comfortably on their cushions in the warm meditation hall while I was cleaning up for all of them. I was angry with the guy who'd left the retreat early. I was put out with the retreat administrator who'd failed to deliver on the arrangement to get the cooks to do some of the cleanup. I was even resentful of the cooks who hadn't done what the administrator told me they'd be doing. And as I stood there and perceived all of those thoughts running through my mind, I realized in that instant that given the form that my mind was in, those thoughts were the natural result of the conditions I found myself in and by the formation of my mind. And fortunately, I was, at that moment, mindful enough from the rest of the retreat practice that I noticed the situation, and I thought to myself, what other mind formation could I choose right now? And mind you, the answer that arose was not, oh, I can get to rainbows and unicorns. It was not, oh, I can feel joy at having the opportunity to serve my brothers and sisters. Candidly, that sort of thing would have been dishonest. It would have been an attempt to impose a false front on the situation. But here's what did arise. Oh, I can form my mind into the shape of someone who's just fundamentally weary after a long, hard day. That was authentic. It was accessible to me, and it was markedly less subject to the clinging and aversion that had so restricted my mind in the prior moment. And with that shift of mindset, I resumed trudging up the hill. I'd been doing what needed to be done. I was tired. When I got to the meditation hall, I went first to the restroom where I cleaned up a bit, ate a candy from my backpack to lift my blood sugar a bit, and quietly, maybe even reverently, shed my sandals and tiptoed to my cushion to listen with as much mind as I had left to the Dharma talk. And ever since then, I've recognized when everything that is coming in is resulting in suffering, one of the first places I try to look is to see the form of mind that I'm holding. And if that mind form or that mindset seems to be the sort of thing that will induce suffering, I ask myself consciously what alternative mindsets are realistically available in that given moment. And if I can find one that seems more likely to allow me to be free of suffering, more compassionate to myself and others, kinder, more intelligent, I try to make the shift toward it. And that has freed me from a lot of suffering. It allowed me to sit beside my mother as she lay dying of breast cancer, to see my mindset that was hugely aversive, thinking I need to get anywhere but here, get away, get away, get away, to see that mindset as a mindset and realize that at that particular moment, the mindset, the mental formation of equanimity was also available to me. And when I shifted to it and I sat without reaching toward or shying away from my mother's coarse, intermittent, and sometimes ragged breathing, I sat holding her always warm hand that never responded except when I tried to withdraw my own. And the third example of mental formations. A couple of months ago, when I found myself mired in depression, I remembered those two experiences and I looked at the mindset. I realized that I could affect it just a little bit, and I found a near relative to depression, but one that wasn't quite as never-ending as depression seems to be, and I shifted toward it. With that different mindset, I didn't resist the need for more sleep than usual. I didn't try to ramp up my physical activity level, but rather I increased the amount of daylight and outdoor time that I got. And what might previously have been a fall into the pit depression was moderated and manageable and temporary. So why did the Buddha list mental formations on his "don't cling to a self here" list? Because we can become attached to particular mindsets. And we can tell ourselves, dark? Yeah, but that's just who I am. The Buddha insisted that even something as deeply ingrained as a mindset, I'm not a math person, is conditioned by experience. And as a conditioned thing, it is subject to change. And as it is subject to change, it cannot be the location of an essential self. The final skanda, or category of experience, is one that, at least in early stages of a meditation practice, is probably best simply noted for future reference and then set aside. The sixth skanda is consciousness. If you want something more to hang your hat on, the Buddha described consciousness in a sutta as the mental aggregate of awareness that arises before a distinct perception occurs. If you think about that description, you'll see that it suggests that consciousness is neither permanent nor is it continuous. Rather, it arises in relation to a sensory experience, remembering that in the Buddhist parlance, thoughts too are a sensory experience. For those of you who've learned the eight-limb path of yoga, the limb that gets translated as withdrawal of the senses, pratyahara, seems to be aimed at this particular experience as well. But what can be inferred from the Buddha's linkage of consciousness to sensory experience is that as sensory experience subsides, the skanda of consciousness can also subside. One way to practice with this is to try to notice when a sense of consciousness kicks back in after being offline for a while. You've probably experienced something like this. You're talking on the phone with someone and you have a bad connection. The sound is fuzzy and intermittent, and you're having a hard time understanding the person you're talking to, so you close your eyes to concentrate on the sound. When you close your eyes, not only are you reducing the details and the distractions of your changing visual input, but after a second or two, your mind is no longer even conscious of the, rather boring, visual perception of the inside of your eyelids. Vision consciousness ends, temporarily. For some folk, the same is true when they're concentrating visually or mentally. Their hearing consciousness simply shuts off. And to get their attention, you have to tap them on the shoulder or wave your hand between their eyes and what they're seeing or reading. Though we think of that as a result of concentration, and it is, what is also going on in that moment that enhances concentration is that the other sensory consciousnesses are turned off. And while intense concentration in one form of sensory consciousness can allow the others to end, it's also possible for all of them to come to an end. But for most of us, that's a long way from our current experience. At any rate, if consciousness is not, as the Buddha of the Pali Canon says it is not, either permanent or continuous, but rather granular and event-specific, then identifying with consciousness as a permanent self is as ill-advised as identifying with any of the other four skandhas. So what are the takeaways from a basic understanding of the five skandhas? Once we know the categories and what's intended by the categories, we can use that structure to examine our experience. We can consider how those experiences relate to the three characteristics of existence that the Buddha taught, unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and not-self. We can more readily see how they arise in response to other causes and conditions. We can see how they result in illusion or delusion. We can see how they become embodiments of our cravings and aversions. And since they can be seen, awareness of them enables us to act with wisdom and intention rather than react unconsciously. What are your thoughts and experiences with the skandhas? I'd love to have your questions.